Okay, you are tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. I'm going to be starting off the show with an interview, and it's going to be an interesting interview, so you should tune in. I have on the phone right now with me Cecil Lyde, a.k.a. Cecil Holmes. Can you hear me, Cecil?
Yes, I can too, Bob, and it sure is exciting to be on the air with you here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, well, let me just tell the audience a little bit about what we'll be talking about today. So Cecil was in a group out of Evanston that was called Experience 2 that recorded for Capitol Records, and he was in L.A. in a bunch of groups, so we'll be talking about his musical career and playing his records. So he was involved with a lot of stuff, and it should be interesting. So first of all, I just mentioned where Experience 2 was from, but where are you originally from, Cecil?
Well, Bob, let me set the record straight right here, man, because a lot of people are wondering what happened to me. I've been out for a while. First of all, my name is Cecil Homeboy Lyde. And I do have several other names with some of the groups that I was with, you know. But Cecil Homeboy Lyde started out in Evanston, Illinois.
Okay. So and, were you born in Evanston?
Yes, I went to school. I was born in Chicago, but we lived in Evanston. And I went to Evanston High School. And, you know, it started with me as a kid. I would go over to the community center there at Foster School and Foster Community Center, and we would be singing all in the bathrooms and the showers back there and all outside in the park. I met some guys that I grew up with. I believe it was Bruce Fisher and Larry Fisher, the Fisher brothers, and Ricky Giles, one of the Giles brothers, and, of course, Sam Jackson. And we started singing doo-wop songs and so forth. But, you know, Bob, it's just amazing from where I've come from to where I am now. I'm so thankful. Even though people don't readily know me off the tip of their tongues, you know, I have had a lot of contact with a lot of great artists.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely be get into all this stuff. I kind of always like to start out with, you know, your roots. So you just described a bunch of guys that you sang with in Evanston. You told me earlier that you actually first started singing at a club solo. Is that right?
Yes. You know, it's very interesting. When I was very young, I could barely say my name without stuttering, you know, and so my mom and dad listened to me singing on the radio. And when the radio came on, I could sing, and they said, wow, he's got some talent. So I began to, as a kid, maybe 10, 11 years old, began to sing music that I heard on the radio. And so they put me in a talent show contest, and this was at the famous club, Club DeLisa in Chicago. Now, all the greats that I know of have once upon a time graced the stage or been performing at Club DeLisa. I mean, you can go back to Billy Eckstein, you can go to Jackie Wilson, you can go to all the famous groups, Temptations. Everybody that came to Chicago, this was before the Regal, came to Club DeLisa. So I was on a show there at Club DeLisa, I think 11 years old. I won the talent show with Red Saunders and his orchestra. I believe I sang a song by the Platters. So that really started me to thinking about, man, you know what, this is fun. So I began to sing, and then I met those guys. But, you know, music was something that delivered me from quite a few things. You know, it brought me out and let me shine a little bit.
So, and you have a musical family too, right? Like you're related to some other music-related people, is that right?
That's correct. You know, early on, I remember listening to my cousins and some of my uncles. They had a group called the Foster Brothers, which was way back when Johnny Mathis had Out Trust in Me and a bunch. Anyway, they had a group, my Uncle Raymond Johnson, you know, even though my name is Cecil Homeboy Lyde, and of course now I'm AK known as Cecil Holden, but my grandfather was Daniel Johnson. He had 21 brothers and sisters from Georgia. And I know I'm from kin to Robert Johnson, the guitar, because I play guitar and all that. But and my grandfather and my uncles had a band, and out of that came the Foster Brothers.
So was their name, did they have the name Foster, or they just picked that as the name of the group?
Well, they picked the name of the group because it was like in our neighborhood back in Evanston, there, our school in our neighborhood was Foster School.
Okay.
You know, it was right there in the heart of the minority community back, you know, back then, and Foster was a, you know, was our grammar school. So they all went to that same grammar school too as well.
And one of your uncles who sang in that group was Don Clay, is that right?
Don Clay was one of my cousin uncles there, and he was very instrumental in promoting me along the way. After he found out I had talent, you know, as a young kid. And, you know, by the way, I was offered contracts when I was young too, but my mom and dad said no. We want him to finish school. I did go to college, but they said no. We want him to have an education. So, you know, I could have been Michael Jackson back then. I was rolling, you know what I'm saying? But Don Clay helped me develop recording. He had a recording studio with, I believe, Otis LaVelle.
Okay.
On North Clark Street. But he was in the group Foster Brothers. He promoted records and was with Barney's One Stop on West Side Chicago. And he worked with Herb Kent and a lot of DJs. And worked down there on Record Row. People don't understand what Record Row is. It's on Michigan Avenue. They had a lot of record companies there. Chess Records, Brunswick, all the little in-house record companies right there with a lot of Chicago musicians and singers and writers. And I hung out there, too, as well.
And Don Clay, even, I know he was one of the owners of Dee Dee Records that put out a lot of the Evanston talent, too.
Exactly. A lot of the Evanston talent that came out of there, you know, you're talking about Bobby Robinson Trio, you're talking about Josephine Taylor, all these people, good friends of mine that I did a lot of shows with in the community and in Chicago with, so Don was very instrumental in promoting music and also marketing, selling music, but he helped me stay, you know, close to the music, you know, close to the business end of the music.
So you just described how you won a talent show when you were, like, you used to sing along on the radio, and you won a talent show when you were 11 years old, and then you said you didn't focus on music because your parents wanted you to be at school, but then you talked about at the beginning how you started singing with a bunch of guys at the community center. How old were you when that happened?
I think I was in, we were in, like, junior high school, you know, middle school, 12, 13, getting ready to go to high school, and we would play in the community center, you know, sports, and then afterwards sports on the way home or whatever, we would be walking and singing, or we'd go into the back area. They had the big shower area, and, you know, we didn't shower or anything like that, but we were the big shower area, and it had an echo, like reverb, so we liked to go back there and sing, and so that gave me a lot of experience first singing with groups. But let me say, when I was in Haven Junior High School, I was a member of the Glee Club.
Okay.
And that really helped me out, too. I mean, I wasn't just singing on the streets in school. I was in some of the school glee clubs. And, you know, so just being, you know, trained at that age in all aspects of music was, you know, was a good thing and helped me develop, you know, overcome fears and also helped develop my vocabulary, you know, and all the above. And then, not to mention the fact that my grandma took me to church. I was at Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church over there on Clark Street in Evanston, and my grandma was in the choir, and I would sing. So I got the experience of gospel. So, you know, it's like music was just getting in, it was in my soul, you know, it was just there.
So the guys that you got together and formed a group with, did you have a name for your group?
Well, we didn't at first. We didn't have a name. We just called it the members.
Okay.
But then after that, we've struggled with different names. And we came out with a name. We had a name called the Cavaliers. Then we found out there was a group in Cleveland called Cleveland Cavaliers. Then we became the Cavaliers. And so then we finally just said, no, we better not have that name. So we decided we were just going to be the Sound Investment, or I think some other kind of name that we had. But the fact of the matter is, even when we had those groups with the five of us, the Fisher Brothers and all that, and we all went on to become writers, you know, songwriters, and to, you know, we broke up But it's very interesting. We met a record manager named Terry Wilson, who was from Detroit, and he was trying to get us into Motown and so forth. So we really had, a lot of influences.
Okay. So what you said you were in like junior high school and high school when you were singing with those guys as the Cavaliers.
Right.
It was that in the mid-60s, something like that?
That was the mid-60s. That was the mid-60s, around 60, 61, 62.
Okay, it was like early 60s then.
Early 60s. And music then was just changing from doo-wop to, doing Motown was out. So popular music was really, it was really hot then. Music was exciting for everybody. It was different kind of music than it is now, but,
So were there, so what types of groups inspired you to sing, like vocal harmony originally? Like were there local, like you already mentioned the Foster Brothers in Evanston, were there other Evanston groups or were you inspired by groups like the Temptations? Like what types of stuff were you singing back then?
Well, yes, I was influenced by the mainstream groups, the Temptations and all the Motown groups, Four Tops and, Spinners, all those types of groups. But even before then, we had some groups in Evanston. One of the groups that probably was underrated that I played with, too, and sang was the Naturals with Carlton Black. I remember when they first formed. Carlton was an exceptionally gifted writer. And, of course, Patty Drew and the Drew Vells. I laugh about that because one of the Drew sisters was my girlfriend. I took her to my high school prom. I was very close to the Drew Vells and Patty Drew. And that sound that they had back then with that record they had, Tell Him and Carlton, Let Love Be True, a lot of those songs were influenced that we had got from the Chicago music scene. It was just very, very vibrant at that point. So, yeah, there were groups there. And then later on when I started going to Record Row, I was in high school, and I met a bunch of groups from Chicago, like the Vontastics, who you and I talked about. I sang on their song, I'll Never Say Goodbye, and I met Maurice and the Radiance, Voice Your Choice, and Ain't No Big Thing, and Don't It Make You Feel Kind of Bad. There's a lot of songs that, in that Chicago style, Chicago really had a lot of hits back then, too, just as many as Motown did.
So were you still in high school at the time? So you said you actually sang on the Vontastics record, I'll Never Say Goodbye?
Actually sang all the records.
So you're in the background somewhere on the record?
Yeah, I'm in the background, and same thing with Don't It Make You Feel Kind of Bad. There's a few other records, too, because I was, I was known as a background singer group with the Live Fisher and Giles. We did backgrounds for commercials too, as well. So studios, when people were recording, and do different parts for them.
Okay. Well, we'll get to that stuff when we get to the Live Fisher and Giles stuff too. So, right. So in the mid '60s, you were like doing background work at like record. You said at different companies at Record Row. What were the main companies you were singing at?
I was singing at Chess Records. Because I just mentioned Maurice and the Radiance and some of the songs that I sang on at Chess Records. At that time, let's see, who else was at Chess Records? Rotary Connection, Minnie Riperton, well, then her name was Andrea Davis. She was the receptionist. And a lot of records on people that recorded at Chess Records there. I also did some blues. Ted Taylor, Little Johnny Taylor. I was just a little person that just wanted to sing parts, and also I was a lead singer too as well. And I just wanted to wait for the right opportunity to get my group and myself out there.
Okay, so the first group you were in that actually recorded was called Experience 2. Is that right?
The first group that actually recorded.
And then release material, I guess.
And then released, right, probably was Experience 2. Although we recorded songs with Cavaliers, they never released it. We did some recordings at Chess
Were you signed to Chess?
No.
Okay.
I was signed to Chess at that time. I went down there. You know, we went down there, and Don had some time open, so we just started. You know, so we started singing. So it was nothing that we were signed to a contract. We were thinking about trying to go to Motown because Terry Wilson had us make a tape, and he took it over to Motown, and we were supposed to go over there and audition. So we were, you know, we were like holding Chicago off a little bit. And
Terry Wilson was your manager at the time?
He was the manager at the time. I think he was one of those people that was singing with the Falcons and Wilson Pickett and those, you know, from that era. And he had a very sharp interest in me as well because he said I sang lead like one of the, you know, like one of the traditional old school singers.
Okay.
You know, I was young. I was out because I experienced all types of music. I've met a lot of people at Chess Records. I met Muddy Waters, McKinley Morganfield. I met Howlin' Wolf. I didn't meet the Beatles because, you know, they were on a different, they were in Europe, you know, at the time. But when I was at Chess, I met a lot of artists as a kid. And I thought nothing of it, really. I just, you know, I just said, okay, well, you know.
Okay, well, So you were doing a lot of studio work in the 60s, and then in the early 70s you joined a group called Experience 2. We've been talking for a while. I wanted to play the record so people could hear it, and then we could talk some more about it. Is that okay?
Yeah, please play the record, but let me tell you about Experience 2. Before you play it, we formed a group, actually Dudley Fair, and came and got myself and Larry and Jerry Soto, and we formed this group called Experience 2, and we played around, and fortunate enough, we got so good, well, Capitol Records became interested, and I was the songwriter and the producer. Okay.
Okay. Well, we'll get more into the details then after I play the record. So this is the one record that Capitol Records released on you guys, and this came out, I think, around 1973, is that right?
1973, right. It did come out, and it was a good record at the time.
Yeah, this song is called "About Time That I Told You."
Someone has taken my place. We have a good life.
Okay, that was just a group called Experience 2 with About Time That I Told You, and it came out on Capitol Records in 1973. And if you're just tuning in, I have a lead singer on that record, Cecil Lyde Holmes, who is talking about his history singing with different groups. So before playing the record, we had been talking about how in the 60s throughout like his high school years, he was singing with a group in school and was going to Record Row, like Chess Records, a lot and doing a lot of backing recording. And that the Experience 2 group was from the early 70s. So what happened, Cecil, in the late 60s?
Well, in the late 60s, I was going down to Record Row, you know, recording, and, you know, meeting a lot of people. I even went to Bamboo Records, where Gene Chandler had his own label. And, you know, Gene Chandler had a style, you know, Chicago style, and I liked his style, so I started writing a couple of songs. And also, I was ran into and met Carl Davis at Brunswick Records, and I was starting to write and give some songs to Marshall and Shalice, who were very good friends of mine. I grew up with Marshall. Marshall is from the west side of Chicago, and Eugene and I became friends. And I would, you know, Eugene would give me pointers about writing and so forth. And, you know, I'd go down there and practice sometimes with the Shalice here. And, you know, as a matter of fact, with Experience 2, we did record at Brunswick. And that's a whole nother story, because after, I think in the late 60s, after I left Record Row, of course, the Vietnam was going on strong. So, you know, I don't know, I was about to get drafted. I was going to Wilson Junior College in Chicago, but, you know, they were drafting. So I joined the Air Force and took off for a couple of years, I think from 68 till 1970, Bob. So even though I was gone from Chicago, I still had a time to develop my craft while I was there, and I formed a group in the Air Force called Fly Boys, and we sang all over the bases, and we're in the worldwide Air Force talent shows and so forth. So music still continued even though I wasn't there.
And you said that you had done some writing for Gene Chandler's label and Carl Davis's labels. Did anything you wrote get recorded in the 60s?
Well, let me just say this. I probably was one of the most songwriters, ghostwriters ever, because I would go in and write little parts on records. They would pay me, but they would never put my names on the records. I'm not going to mention no names, but I did that for quite a few artists there, and always still writing my own songs, which, as you can see, I have a number of CDs out right now, current of material that I never released, but we'll get to that point. But yes, I did do some writing on Record Row.
So when did you come back from the Air Force?
You there?
Yeah, when did you come back from the Air Force?
I came back from the Air Force in 1970.
And Experience 2, did they form shortly after you came back?
No, what it was, I think when I got back, I ran into my good friend Dudley Fair. We were in high school together, too. Dudley was singing with another group of guys, but they didn't have a record or anything like that. They were just fooling around. And so Dudley called me and said, man, I always wanted to sing with you. He said, I was in this group. And let me just say this. Dudley was in a group called The Soul Experience.
Okay.
And you know, when I got back, I believe it was Billy Dickens and Ray Barge, who's passed away, and Dudley, and Bobby Williams, who played the guitar. Bobby Williams worked for the bank. But anyway, the group broke up. And so Dudley said, man, the group broke up, and I want to keep on going. He said, let's make Experience 2. I said, okay. So Dudley came up with Let's Make Experience 2. I went and got Larry, and Jerry Soto played the guitar. Eric Collins played the bass. Tootie Bryson, Everett Tootie Bryson, the world-famous percussionist. And Tootie played with everybody. Played percussion, for Rufus and George Benson and Dr. Strait. He played with a lot of people, too. He's from Evanston also, too. And Bobby Stringer played the drums. So, you know, we had a really good lineup, and so we called it Experience 2.
And who sang vocals besides you? You sang lead vocal, is that right?
Yeah, I sang lead vocals, and, well, we all sang lead vocals, but I sang most of the lead vocals, and I did all the writing for the group, because I had been writing songs, like I said, hanging around with different other people that I knew on Record Row. I'd run into, you know, Tyrone Davis, Shy Lye, just all of the Chess groups, and you know, so writing songs and vocabulary and all that I told you that I had to study and learn became, you know, kind of second nature to me, you know. And so I had quite a few songs. And
On the Experience 2 records, singing backup was just the band members that you already named, is that right?
Yeah, singing backup, we were the main singers. Myself, Dudley Fair, and Larry Fisher, who was still a Fisher and Giles. And meanwhile, Giles, at that time, even though we live Fisher and Giles and the Giles brothers had been singing, Giles then, in 1970, he was in Southern Illinois in Carbondale.
Okay.
And so he wasn't available at the time to be in Experience 2. So, you know, he was just hanging out there. So it was myself, Larry Fisher, and Dudley. We were the main vocalists, and also played guitar.
So you guys came up with the idea of forming a self-contained band. Is that right? Like you didn't just want to form a vocal group. You wanted to form a band. Where'd you guys get that idea from?
Exactly. We kind of switched over because even though I started out with, you know, with just being a solo singer and then into a group, like stand-up groups, well, we kind of, when the guitars came fashionable and all that, a lot of groups went to self-contained. So, you know, we said, okay, let's try to be self-contained. But we still had three singers out front. Sometimes I would play guitar and sometimes I wouldn't. And we still would do a combination of dancing, playing, and singing. And it's kind of like developed modern soul. Like I said, I say now that we were right on the cusp of modern soul, you know, and I think that's one reason why Capitol wanted to sign us an experiment. Because we did six songs, but they only released one single.
So you guys were together for about two, three years before you signed to Capitol, is that right?
Yeah, we were together since 1970, yeah, about 2 years before we signed with Capitol in 72.
What were you doing for those 2 years? Were you doing like shows and stuff? Were you trying to get signed?
Yeah, we would do shows. We would go up to Milwaukee. We played a lot of festivals. We go to Milwaukee. We go to Indiana. You know, we just played the Midwest, Davenport, Iowa, you know, Quad Cities. You know, we would just do the Midwest areas.
And then,
of course, Chicago, you know.
And how'd you end up getting a record deal with Capitol Records?
Exactly. I ended up getting a deal with Capitol Records. You know, and let me just say this for those listening out there. You know, sometimes even though you get with a major label does not mean that you're going to be an instant success. Everything has to click properly. At that time, even though we had a shot, we had a major deal, you know, the group broke up. We were kind of unstable. The music was changing a little bit, you know, and I don't think Capitol really put their heart into our deal because I could tell that they didn't give us an album deal. They wanted to try some singles first. And, you know, it was my contention that if they're going to sign you to a deal, hey, you know, sign me to a 5-album deal or something, you know, that has longevity in it. But this was just a trial basis. And it kind of hit and miss. The group got discouraged before the second single could be released. And, you know, we never stayed together.
So you recorded six songs, but they only released two of them.
That's correct.
And so that that record I just played, About Time, that I told you, did it get any play in Chicago?
Yeah, it did play Chicago. at that time, Abigail was playing at station, WVON. I think Stevie-O, E. Rodney Jones.
Okay. And
and you know what? That brings us to a point that at that time, because of my Uncle Don Clay, I knew some of the radio people. I knew E. Rodney Jones and Jay Johnson and some of these people I had met. So that's why I think another reason why Calvin said, well, we can get the record play.
Okay.
I think that, you know, that had a bearing on it too as well.
And you actually produced the record, is that right?
Well, yeah, I was actually the line producer and also the publisher and the writer. Paul Gallus, at that time, who lived in Mount Prospect, was the largest independent record promoter in the Midwest at that time. And he became manager of the group. And even though the record says produced by Paul Gallus, I'm the one who actually produced it. I was signed to the deal with Paul Gallus and Maury Lathauer. Now, people don't realize that Maury Lathauer, Paul and Maury, they used to be musicians with Capitol. I think Paul was a drummer, Maury was a sax player or something. Maury was an executive at Capitol. And he actually signed Patty Drew.
Okay.
Maury was looking to help and sign, but, you know, I'll be honest with you, like I said, I never saw no money from that. You know, I got an opportunity. So we were supposed to follow up with an album, but the group broke up because of the single.
Just because it didn't get promoted enough?
Yeah, it didn't get promoted enough. You know how when you have different opinions in the group, some people thought it should have been promoted more than it was, and, you know, we couldn't keep the group settled down enough to really have faith in Capitol at that time. I mean, they might have had faith in us, but we didn't have faith in them because they didn't give us tour support.
You had told me some story earlier about the actual song, about time that I told you that originally it had a different sound when you were working on it. Is that right?
Exactly. Since I had been working closely with groups like the Shy Lights and the Artistics and different groups out of Chicago, of course, we had a sound sort of like that, but in a self-contained fashion. And so when I wrote the song, it didn't have the change, like you mentioned, of Fifth Dimension in it. We were at, when we got to the recording studio, we were sitting up playing the song, just fooling around. The engineer was doing something technical, told us to just play. So we started playing the Fifth Dimension change just to kill some time. And for some reason, they wanted to put that into the song.
So what you're talking about is at the chorus, how it speeds up and kind of,
how to change the tempo, right.
Okay, so you're describing that as more of like a crossover, like pop-type sound, and you're saying the original version had a more of a soul-type chorus.
Exactly. The original version had more of the original groove to it, and, I mean, it sounded great just the way it was. And when the engineers heard it, and also Paul, they said, "Oh man, that's a pop change. We can get this place. I mean, you know, y'all can't get that played." They said, "Yes, we can. We can have it played in all the pop stations, all the white stations." And so I said, "No, I don't think you can." I said, "But if you promote it to the same market, you know, that all the soul records go to and the black music go to," I said, "you won't have a problem." So they said, "No, we're gonna cross it over." So they did it. Paul and Maury took that record, went to the pop market with it, and didn't get the stations.
Okay, so they failed. Yeah. They failed to promote it, you're saying?
Exactly. You know, all radio, all music is controlled by radio. If you don't get airplay on your radio, people will never know that it's a record. And some records have to be played in rotation for the theme or for the spirit to grow on you. And at that time, if you don't get enough spins, as they say right now, it's not going to catch on. So we never did even get enough spins. And, you know, as an artist right now, even, you know, I'm not getting spins that I should be. But you know what? I think the fact that I'm on your show right now, people hearing me right now, and they go out and they'll find out that, hey, you know, here's a forgotten artist of great musical value. So I appreciate you, you know, having your show on and definitely having me on, Bob.
Yeah, well, a lot of artists cut great records. There's so much lost music, and you know, very few people actually got a break. So I'm always glad to feature that music on my show. Like, I really like that "About Time That I Told You" record, and which I think we should go on to. So you said that the group broke up, and then I know that in the later 70s you recorded in California with a couple people you sang with before as Lyde Fisher Giles. Is that right?
Exactly. I mentioned that Giles at that time was in Carbondale going to school, and I had been down in Carbondale to visit him for a while, and I, in fact, going to school there a few semesters myself, left him down there. But when we broke up, right after we broke up, we had one more shot. The group broke up before I went to California. I went to E. Rodney Jones in Chicago. I said, "E. Rodney, I want to make another record, but not like the About Time I Told You." So he took me down to Carl Davis's studio at Brunswick Records, and experience too. We recorded a song. I think it was "Living Together Ain't Easy." I don't have a copy of it right now, and I keep asking Carl every time I see where those tapes are. Carl Davis said he don't even have a copy of the tape. And I don't know what happened to E. Rodney. He was in New Orleans, and E. Rodney and Will Jones.
Well, you know, he died.
Yeah, so he's passed
okay.
away.
Yeah.
So I have no idea where those tapes are, but I do have some tapes of Lyde Fisher and Giles, which is what I'm mentioning that you just spoke of. Went to California, and I began recording in Beverly Hills United Artists Studio with producer and an engineer named Bert Azzadello.
What year were you doing this?
I was in 74, 75, yeah, 1975.
And how'd you end up going to, why'd you leave Chicago to go to California?
Well, we went to California. Bruce Fisher, who was Larry Fisher's brother, that sang in our original group back in grammar school and middle school. Well, Bruce moved to California and was writing songs with Billy Preston. In fact, he wrote all of Billy Preston's hits, "Nothing from Nothing," "Will It Go Round the Circle," "You Are So Beautiful to Me." So Bruce gave me and Larry, said, "Hey, man, come out, let's form the group back again and see if we can." So again, we would try to put the group back together. So Larry and I went out to California. Rick Giles then was still in Carbondale, Illinois, and Bruce and Larry and us, we got together and we tried to do some singing. Bruce was on United Artists. Bruce was on United Artists. He was writing, and we wrote a song together, "At the End of a Love Affair," which is a single. And
you're saying you wrote a song called "At the End of a Love Affair" with Bruce, and it was who sang it? You're saying Bruce actually sang the record?
Actually sang the record. I wrote it.
And it was released as by Bruce Fisher, you're saying?
Released by Bruce Fisher.
On United Artists.
On United Artists Records.
And you're saying that Bruce got you and the other guys signed?
His brother. Yes.
Signed to United Artists.
Yeah. So then finally we called Giles and he came out to California. And we began singing and rehearsing in United Artists studio with Bert. We tried to sign with United Artists, but at that time, United Artists really didn't have a black music or a soul music department. The only artists they had Vernon Birch, and they had Bobby Womack.
Okay, and War.
And War.
Okay.
And finally they had Tina Turner a little bit, but then those are the only black artists that they had. And then they had after that, they had Enchantment, I think. Yeah, they had Enchantment came after we left. But we were recording with Burt. Burt had a independent label distributed by United Artists, Hab Records, and we recorded Live Fisher and Giles, a whole album full of songs. However, we only released one single, I'll Always Love You and Serve You, Right to Suffer. Reason being, Bruce got sick. Live Fisher and Giles began to sing. Well, Fisher and Giles, at this time again, they fell out.
Well, let me play the record, and we could talk a little bit more. Is that okay?
Play the record. It's an excellent record, and I'm releasing all the catalog on this right now. It's never been out, so this is something fresh and new.
Okay, so this is the Live Fisher Giles single that was released, and it was released on a sub-label of United Artists, right? What was the label called?
Habitat Records, H-A-B Records.
Okay, so this is Live Fisher Giles with I'll Always Love You.
For someone woman.
Okay, that was just a group called Lied Fisher Giles, who, as we've been talking about, actually had members of Experience 2 and of earlier groups that Cecil sang with. And that was the one single that they released called I'll Always Love You. And Cecil, do you remember what year? You said you recorded around 76. Do you remember what year it came out? Was it around 76?
Actually, it came out around 78. And we were in Los Angeles at the time working with Bert Agudelo from United Artists Records. So he put it on an independent label. And you know what? That song is still very popular today. I'll Always Love You. It sort of reminds me of the old groups that have a modern sound, you know, like Manhattans and different group deals and so forth. And it's a very nice song.
Okay. And so that it didn't really get played or promoted, right?
No, you know what? Most of the time, like I mentioned, if a recording doesn't get adequate airplay, then it doesn't excel as much. So, yeah, it wasn't promoted, you know, like it should have been. And one of the reasons is again, I say, when groups break up, because Lied Fisher and Giles, we did break up, and I finally found a formula. And then we broke up.
So you were talking about just before I played the record that you had broken up. So how long were you together in L.A.?
In L.A., Lied Fisher and Giles, we were together from like 1975 through 1979.
Okay.
About 5 years in Los Angeles. And we were working on trying to put our group sound back together. With Lied Fisher and Giles, Bruce got real sick because it would have been four of us like we had back in Evanston again, and you can hear the sound with just three of us. But Bruce got real sick, so we had to just go with the three of us then, you know.
So was Bruce still writing? Was he still a writer, though?
Yeah, he was still writing with Billy Preston and different artists, Donald Byrd and Blackbird.
Okay, so
writing, but he couldn't do much singing.
And the group broke up just because some of the guys started fighting, didn't get along.
Yeah, we had some. They had some in-house fighting that did not concern me as well.
Okay,
I always felt like I was like Otis from the Temptations. I'm only trying to keep these guys together and say, hey, we got what it takes, we got the material, we got the plan. You guys just have to be cool. And just, you know, whatever it is that you're going through, just relax and work through it. But sometimes that doesn't happen.
Yeah, well, I know it's difficult in the music industry, especially after you've been trying for so long.
Very difficult.
So, and you had told me that as Lied Fisher Giles, you guys had done some advertisement, like ad work. Is that right?
Well, how we really got started, we had perfect harmony because we would walk around singing like Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, you know, Lied Fisher and Giles. We met Charles Stepney, who was a producer and an advertiser. He made a lot of advertising. People don't realize that Chicago back in the 70s and early 60s was the media and the advertising capital of the country, really. People would come in and record commercials for advertising, for radio. Charles was one of those producers. He hired us to sing backgrounds because we were really a tight harmony unit, you know, three of us. And that's how we got started singing a tight harmony.
So was that before you went to L.A., you did commercials?
And that was about 1970, 1971, after I just got back from the military. Hooked up with Fisher and Giles and Charles Stepney for a while. And then after Rick left and went to Carpenter, had to go back to school, that's when we formed Experience 2. But Charles Stepney was a master producer. He taught and produced the Dells, Ramsey Lewis, and one of the biggest groups, Earth, Wind & Fire. Most of that was Charles Stepney showing Maurice and all those people and even us how to record, how to use delay and how to stack your vocals and do all those sweetening sounds that you hear on records now today. Charles Stepney is one of those that taught me how to do that.
Do you remember some of the ads that you did jingles for, like some of the ads you did? Did you do any big ones?
It's Good to Have Around. We did Sears at the Style Isle, Gypsy Rose Wine, you know, just a number of major and minor, you know, market ads. And he had another girls group there called Kitty Haywood and the Haywood Singers. They were our friends, and I think one of the ladies there sang with Emotions, Dee Dee, you know, she wanted their cut. But anyway, it was a very tight-knit vocal thing back then. You know, if you could sing tight vocals, they, like you said, you could go to Record Row and they would just hire you to do vocals. They didn't have to know who you were.
So in the late 70s then, after Lyde Fisher-Giles broke up, did you continue to do music?
Yes. That is how I managed to... I said, you know what, no more. I'm not helping any more groups. I began to do work on my solo act. And actually, I changed my name to Cecil Holden, H-O-L-D-E-N, you know. And the one reason why I did that, it says in my bio that my mom and dad, well, actually my mom remarried to John Holden, and they said, we want you to do a gospel album. And when you do it, name it Cecil Holden. So I did that. I put out a gospel CD called Hard Fighting Soldier, which is a national song. I'm sure a lot of people have heard it. And I started using Cecil Holden, but I decided I had enough of groups, and I'm going to work on my solo projects.
And you were still in L.A. at the time?
Right, I was still in L.A., so I wrote an album called Stone Free, okay? And if anybody wants to know or see what Stone Free is, they all they have to do is go on the Internet and put in Stone Free. And you'll see it's a CD on P-Vine Records in Japan. Actually, it's an import.
So P-Vine reissued the album, right?
Yeah, P-Vine reissued the album. The album was on my own label.
What year did it come out?
It actually came out in 1978, that album did. And an album called Stone Free.
And it was just a solo album that you produced on yourself?
Yeah, it was an album that I could do on myself. I still had some group sounds in it, but I started to sing more solo, more R&B, more funk-type music. And it was on my own label. I had my own label called All West Records. And you know what? That's a very hard thing to do. Here I was, an artist trying to make it on a major label, wasn't getting too much success. Had to come out with my own label because... it was very hard to get a recording deal by yourself. People would always ask me where my group is. I said, you know what? There's no more group. So I end up having to do my own label and just do my own thing. And it's been rewarding. It hasn't been a lot of financial rewards, but it's been gratifying to know that I can sing and record.
How did P-Vine Records in Japan end up reissuing it? Like, what year did the reissue come out?
Well, the reissue just came out a couple of years ago. Since this invention of the Internet, people would go and search for hard-to-find artists or hard-to-find CDs or albums. And, of course, much like yourself, if people go and put my name in the Internet, Cecil Lyde or Cecil Holden or one of my groups, Experience 2, Homeboy, COL, they will find out that I'm one of the most sought-after collectors artists out there. And so I'm starting now to come out with all of my catalogs, which I have been held back. One of the reasons why I held my catalog back, and let me just say this, Bob, is that a lot of record companies wanted to take advantage of me. They wanted to take my music, not pay me, not give me any kind of control over it whatsoever. Big artists have been through that. I don't care if it's Little Richard, if it's Prince, whoever. At some point in time, you know you get tired of that. You know, you're going to sign me up, take all my rights, and still nothing's going to happen. So I decided not to sign with any majors, not until they're going to give me a righteous deal.
Okay. So you talked about how you put out your solo record on All West Records. And you actually recorded and put out some more material on All West also, right? Is that correct?
Exactly. Actually, it started with that album, Stones Free, and then something really, really nice happened. After Homeboys LFG was on hold, I came out. I liked that word homeboy. As a matter of fact, I created Homeboy Music back in 1973 with ASCAP. People need to know I'm the original homeboy. I'm the one who started all of that.
Okay.
And so I had Homeboy Music. So I had an album, a CD called Homeboy and the COL, which stands for C for Lie. Well, I put out a 45 called I'll Make It on My Own. And I was in L.A. at the time. A gentleman came up to me from England, U.K., David Reistrick. Never forget his name. He said, "Oh, I like that. I'll Make It on My Own. Let me take that back to England." So he bought a box of 45 records from me in L.A. and took those records back over to England. And that song, I'll Make It on My Own, has been on the English compilations on Northern Soul and a lot of different compilations over in Europe on the international market. So Homeboy COL, it went from Stone Free to Homeboy COL. And that was a good thing, you know, that I've had that, you know, that I had that label. People are still trying to get that 45.
So you released that 45. You also released some albums as Homeboy COL, is that right?
Exactly. I released another album after that. Now, all these are 80s music because Homeboy came out in 1982. Then 1984, I released another Homeboy album, Outbreak, which was an album of dance-type, funk-type music, you know. At that time, music was really popping. I mean, they had modern soul was at its peak. Disco and modern soul, you had disco, you had, you had trance, you had all the disco groups, Taste of Honey, you know, and so I still like dance music, so I put out Homeboy COL. I had a record called You Turn Me Out, You Turn Me Loose, a lot of dance material.
So how many albums did you put out on Homeboy COL?
Well, actually, two.
Okay.
Homeboy COL, two albums out, and then, well, actually, three, Homeboy LFG, Homeboy COL, and Homeboy Outbreak. So actually, if you're really counting, you would probably say three albums of Homeboy, okay? And this is material that if you play it right now, it'll stand the test of time. And just like About Time I told you, that Experience 2 CD album is going to, when we reissue that, it's going to be a breath of fresh air for the music business.
Okay. And you actually had a band. Did you have a band that played around L.A. also? Is that right?
Yes, I did. I had a band called A Homeboy and COL, and we played a lot of shows in L.A., and it was comprised of a lot of top L.A. musicians. I think Terry Carter on the keyboards, Marcel Marty Garner on drums, and of course Everett Tootie Bryson. He still lives in California. He's a percussionist. Now, people don't realize that Tootie Bryson, if you know percussion, you can think of famous percussionists, Ralph McDonald or Paulini DaCosta or a lot of famous, or Tito Puetti, you know, a lot of. Well, Tootie Bryson from Evanston, he's a famous percussionist, played with Rufus and Chaka, played with George Benson, played with a lot of artists. He is on all of these records that we play on. Tootie and I played a lot of sessions together in Los Angeles.
Okay. And one other thing I forgot to ask you before, but I think you told me earlier that Experience 2 did some big shows too, is that right?
Oh, yes. I forgot to tell you that one of the highlights of Experience 2 was we did a show with Curtis Mayfield and the Spinners at the Aragon Ballroom. It was a sold-out show. I mean, it was a fantastic show, and we ended up getting rave reviews. I talked to Dudley, and it was an article in the Sun-Times. I don't have the date of it, but it was in 1973. And it was in the Sun Times about how we were a group that played in this basement in Evanston, but we arrived on stage and the reviewer said he'd like to come up and see us anytime, and that we did an excellent job on that concert, you know, and it was very, very good. You know, it was just a highlight, one of the highlights of that era was to play with Curtis. I had met Curtis Mayfield, you know, on Record Row a number of times. As a matter of fact, Curtis, I listened to his guitar playing a lot when I was coming up and playing by ear. I played all the Curtis Mayfield songs.
And going back to the homeboy group that you had, did that group stay together throughout the 80s?
Yeah, you know what? We kind of did stick together amongst the 80s. And one of the things that kind of cut that short a little bit was my parents got very terminally ill back in Chicago. So when that last homeboy record came out, my mom, my dad had already passed away. My mom got terribly ill. And I had to make a decision on whether I'm going to come back to Chicago and take care of it and deal with things. So, you know, I said, let me just put this on hold. So I left L.A., sold my house, and moved back to Chicago, and really didn't promote the Homeboy CDs after that, because I said I wanted to make sure I spent time with my loved ones and my family. And, you know, that's what I did.
Well, that's obviously an important thing to do. So did you do any music stuff since the 80s?
Yes, I did. Since the 80s, back in 1990s. Now, if you go up to the 90s, I hooked back up with Dudley Fair again, and I had a CD that I called Greatest Hits. And what I did was, it says Cecil Homeboy Live, a.k.a. anonymously known as Cecil Hogan. And I have a lot of songs from a lot of the CDs that we have out, and even we have a brand new CD out called New Jack Steppin'. It's one of those Steppin' CDs, you know, Chicago's very good for Steppin'.
Yeah.
And I've worked with a lot of the Steppers. I've worked with Mary Green Promotions. I've worked, and let me just call a name, Gus Redman. I don't know if you're familiar with Gus Redman.
Yeah, he's been up here with the Lost Generation and some of the other. He's helped out with some. He actually helped me hook up the interview I'm doing next week with the Next Movement too.
Exactly.
You're saying he helped promote your CD?
He helped promote the CD, and also Gus and I used to promote records with Gus. People don't realize that even while I was working on my own product, I was in promotion and distribution. I worked with people like Gus Redman, who grew up, you know, a good friend of mine, me, Gus, and Marshall from the Shy Life. All of us, we've been friends for many years. So I worked a lot of product with Gus, and know everybody, you know, in that era that was with my uncle and all the rest of these. Now, Gus promoted all of Brunswick's records, you know.
Yeah.
Tyrone Davis and Leo. You know, I worked with a lot of people. So, but, yeah, Gus lives in Evanston. Right now, we talk periodically now, as a matter of fact. Another person I work with, I'm going to call a name. This is ancient here. Dave Clark. People don't realize Dave Clark at one time was the oldest record promotion man in the business. Worked blues and did all of Malico Records, ZZ Hill, and a bunch of stuff. I worked for Dave, too, in L.A. And Dave Clark promoted and touched artists going all the way back to Sam Cooke. People don't realize this is history. You've got a lot of people out there, people like Dave and Gus and all these, Alvin Thomas passed, a lot of people who were record promoters that helped a lot of people. Even people like myself, they helped.
So that Steppin' CD that you mentioned, that's the newest thing you did that people should look out for, is that right?
Yes, I have two new CDs out now, and I'm going to send them to you. I have New Jack Steppin', and I have another CD called If You Don't Mind, Modern Soul. I mean, these are some of the newest songs that I record. They've never been out. And I decided, since the Internet, people are wanting to know, so I'm going to release all of my products. And, you know, just let it come back alive. And definitely, I would like to come back and do a reunion with Experience 2 and just do a lot of things, because I still play shows, you know, whenever I'm booked to do that.
Okay, well, definitely let me know if you do anything. I'll definitely let people know about it. Thanks so much for telling your story. It was very interesting going back all the way to Evanston in the 60s through all the stuff you did in the 70s and 80s to today.
Back memories. Yes, you did. And I appreciate everything that you're doing for music. And there's people like you who are pioneers that help keep the music going. And, you know, music is a universal language. And music is very important. It culturally helps us to realize what life is all about. And there's people like yourself who make this business what it really is. You know, if you can refer anybody to me that could help me, or if I could help them, that would be greatly, greatly appreciated, Bob, you know.
Okay, well, yeah, if anyone wants to get in contact with you, they can look for your website, or they could contact me, too.
Yeah, all you got to do is go to the Internet, put in Cecil Light or Cecil Holden or Homeboy, any of those. Eventually, you're going to be able to get in touch with me, you know, and I really do, you know, I really do appreciate it. If there's anything that I can do, you know, for you, just let me know. I really appreciate you having me on your program, you know, and we shall stay in touch. The last time I did an interview, I think, was with Kev Roberts.
Okay. Okay, well, he's actually putting on something in Chicago in March. Like, he's flying in all these people from England, and he's going to have all these old Chicago artists from the back in the day perform, so.
Yeah, he's got in touch with me. I might be there.
Okay. So, are you, finally, I want to play another track from the unreleased Lyde Fisher Giles album. What track do you recommend I play?
Play Golden Ring, because Golden Ring is a song about positive life, about how life is good, and if you just hold on and be yourself and reach out, you know, we can still have the American dream. We can still catch a golden ring, but you have to have love in your heart. You can't have, a lot of negative stuff going on. So Golden Ring would be a good song.
Okay. Okay, well, thanks so much again for being on the radio for this interview.
Yes.
And this last track I'm going to play is Lyde Fisher Giles, and this track is called Catch a Golden Ring.